Well, we're on to the almost final chapter. School's getting out. You guys are going to getting out. I want to ask you guys a question. Have you ever, is there something you do that when somebody else comes and looks at it, you can tell, like, well, they don't really understand it? I'll give you an example. So if I'm doing anything to my house, he's going, yeah, all the time, right? When I'm doing, I've lived in a house virtually all my life, a bunk house for a while, but and so you'd think that I would have a pretty good point of view on a house. But anytime I do anything on my house, I end up going, hey, Steve, can you come over and look at this? You know, and he does. And I'm always amazed at how much he knows and what he sees that I don't see. I think, you know, I've researched it. I went on YouTube. I'm an expert. And he comes over and I'm like, wow, I don't know anything about this. And we've been hanging around for what, 35 years or something like that. You think, you know, anyhow. Or, and for me, it was always when people would come around the farm, the ranch, you know, they would look at cows totally different than I did, and they would say, they're stupid, aren't they? As they roll down the window and go, moo, you know. I'm like, okay. And when I got married, Lisa got pregnant. I didn't get pregnant. She got pregnant. So we went to Lamaze, and I was a star. I was the star of that because I had been around more birthings than everybody put together. Thousands of lambs, lots of calves. And so I was pretty cocksure of myself. And then, but the one thing I can tell you is animals don't get a thing called Braxton Hicks. I didn't know what that was. I heard about it, but hey, look, I've already done that. So, well, Lisa got Braxton Hicks. So we went to the OB, and I say OB because I can't see an obstetrician. Can anybody say that word? So anyway, we go in there, and he was really cool because, you know, he probably knew within 2 seconds, right, what was going on. But he says, you know, and he let us, you know, sit in the lobby, and then he says, nah, it's Braxton Hicks, go home. So I went, wow. He's got a unique point of view, doesn't he? He sees things differently than we do. So what I want to do, before we start this, I want us to try to see things differently if we can. The Bible is really one, the Old Testament is one big, gigantic, polemic argument. And it argues for two things, the law and the prophets. Okay? The law is Jesus' manifesto, and the prophets is predicting him. So that's what it basically does in a picture. Okay? And I'll give you an example. The best example I can give you, well, not the best, but one that I can give you that everybody understands. If you go to 1 Kings, I think it's 17, around verse 8. If you go there, you'll remember the story. It's about Elijah. He leaves King Ahab with a pronouncement of a drought, you remember? And then he's going to encounter a widow. And you remember when he encounters the widow, he's hungry. Well, he goes by a brook. He's supposed to drink from the brook, and the crows provide for him. And then the brook dries up, and then he goes into this land, and this is a pagan land. And so he gets there, and he runs into the widow. And he says, can I have a drink of water? And she says, sure. And he goes, you know, and while you're at it, can you make me some bread? And you remember what she said to him? She said, I don't have enough. She said, you know, in fact, and I love this, it's a superlative. She says, I have just a handful of flour and a little bit of oil, and I'm going to go make it, and then me and my son are going to eat it, and then we're going to what? We're going to die. A little dramatic, but that's what she says. I don't have enough. So he says, no, go do it anyway. And then what's the next thing that happens? And he tells her, he says, you go ahead and do it. Don't worry. You won't run out for as long as the drought lasts. And it happens. And then what happens next? The next thing on the scene is what? Remember, her son dies. And then Elijah resurrects him. He lays on this really weird story about him laying on him 3 times. And there's this exchange between them. But he resurrects him. Okay? So what's that story about? What do you think? What do you think the theme of that story is?
God.
Huh?
God.
God, yes, for certain. But what's God's message?
Trust in me.
Trust in me. Follow instructions, certainly.
Have faith.
Have faith. Remember where it takes place. It takes place in a land that is pagan, and it has two gods. Anybody know what the gods are? I don't expect you to know this, you know, unless you're a geek, sort of like me. So it's Baal and Mott. Very well known. The biblical narrative will tell you this before and after. And Baal is the god of provision. He's the god of sustenance. He's a god that provides water and food. And what happens? He encounters this widow who's starving to death. Okay? And the god of Elijah does the providing here. So that's the polemic, right? It's a railment against strange gods. The other god is Mott, who's the underworld god. He's the god of death. And so Elijah, again, does a resurrection. Okay? So again, you have one that is against, he's railing against the law. What's the first commandment? No strange gods, right? So there's polemic argument through what's happening in the story that it's a railment against strange gods, and it also is for the commandments. Remember, it's either the law or the prophets. And the second one is about resurrection. What does that point to? That's right. So that's the prophets. Okay, guys, is everybody kind of clear on that? It's pretty cool, isn't it? Isn't that neat the way the Bible? And the Bible just does that over and over and over again if we'll look. So what we're talking about with Esther, and we have it, the great reversal, part two, from when Lauren was last week talking about it, or I call it the conclusion of competing edicts, because all we did is we got an edict that says we have permission to go out there and defend ourselves, right? So it's the conclusion to that, and it's the great reversal. And remember, we haven't mentioned God in this at all, but he's all over the place. So there's a polemic argument here, isn't there? So I want us to kind of try to see, you know, there's the story. And by the way, that first story I was talking about, Jesus in the New Testament uses the story of Naaman, the leper, and this Elijah story to make a point, doesn't he? In his church. And they ended up, they wanted to stone him for it. So anyway, I wanted to set us up like that. Let's read this. It's a pretty long chapter, so we broke it up, and we're gonna end at verse 19, and it really is a sort of a natural break. I'm wondering why they did it the way they did. It might have been better to move everything into 10, but anyhow, I'm pretty sure Mordecai wrote this, so especially the last part. Okay, now, in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain mastery over him, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. The Jews gathered in the cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could stand against them. For the fear of them had fallen on all the peoples, all the officials of the provinces and all the satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews. For the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces. For the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. The Jews struck all the enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and did as they pleased to those who hated them. In Susa, the citadel itself, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men, and also killed Pershandatha, Dolphin, Aspatha, Paratha, Adelia, Ardatha, Parmashta, Arisa, Eridai, and Vazatha, or if you're from Texas, Vizatha, the son of Haman and the son of Hammedatha, the enemies of the Jews, but they laid no hands on the plunder. That very day, the number of those killed in Susa, the citadel, was reported to the king. And the king said to Esther, in Susa, the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men, and also the 10 sons of Haman. What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Exclamation point. Now what is your wish? It shall be granted to you. And what further is your request? It shall be fulfilled. And Esther said, if it please the king, let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows. So the king commanded this to be done. A decree was issued in Susa, and the 10 sons of Haman were hanged. The Jews who were in Susa gathered also on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they killed 300 men in Susa, but they laid no hand on the plunder. Now the rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also gathered to defend their lives, and got relief from their enemies and killed 75,000 of those who hated them, but they laid no hand on the plunder. This was the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day they rested and made that a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore the Jews of the villages who live in the rural towns hold the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day for gladness and feasting as a holiday, and as a day which they send gifts of food to one another. That's a Jewish holiday I could get behind. Okay, so I thought what would help us a little bit is to get a little chronology. We have Western minds, if you'll see up there on the screen. It's about 3 years when we started this thing where there's a big party, right? That's the year 483 BC. So, and what that is when I say 3 years, that's from when he started his reign. And then it's 4 years later when she goes to Ahasuerus. Presumably she to sleep with him, and that's in 479. And then you have about 4 years later when Haman begins to cast lots. Now some of these things happen within a 3 day period, but then there's bigger stretches than you think here. And it was kind of difficult to figure this out, so I went and got help with it. But at any rate, so there's some time, and he does this. You'll remember it says that he does this every day for a year to get that right day, that lucky day. And then the decree comes out in 474. And then the date planned for the annihilation is on the 12th. It's a year later. Mordecai's decree is issued. And so it looks like about 8.5 months after Mordecai. So he's got about 3 months to prepare for the counterattack. And then the date upon which the Jews can defend themselves is the exact same date. And then you'll see the sons are hanged, and then the Feast of Purim, which will be the other part of night. So that's just sort of a timeline to get everybody kind of, you know, caught up as we finish the book. Any questions on that? Does it surprise you? Anything in there surprise you? Okay. I think it surprised me that it took that long for you know, when Haman started casting, when he cooked up the plan for it to actually happen, I think it was longer than I imagined. So that was the only thing that surprised me. And then in verse 1, it uses the word reverse straightforwardly for us to get headed in the right direction. So here's where you guys take over. What is reverse so far? We talked a little bit about that last week. So but we've got more information now. So what's reversed? This is the part where I drink coffee and you talk. We can start. I knew there would be a little silence. Everybody's a little shy. What's reversed for the king? We'll start with him. What's different about what's happened with the king? Huh?
The edict that he made.
The edict? Okay, so yeah, well, Mordecai made the edict. He gave him the signature ring, but that's maybe a, or not Mordecai, Haman. But he lost his first queen. That's changed, huh? And who did he get in replacing her? He got Esther. So that's reversed. At this point, that's reversed. So he lost and he got a queen. But you remember when we start this in chapter 1, it's kind of funny. The consultants to him said, you know what, we need to get you a better queen. And we're sitting there going, that's pretty mean because, you know, what did Vashti do? And she didn't really do anything wrong. But in retrospect, as you look at that, when we start looking at his situation with Esther, he did get a better queen. She's a superior queen. So there's that. What else is reversed for him?
The edicts.
The edicts, right? So he's got one. Well, he's got competing edicts now. He's got a horse race, basically, is what this is. Because nothing's certain yet. Well, I guess when we get to this, it's the certainty has come in. But so he had different edicts. How about how does he rule? How is he ruling before? Not as passive. He's way more involved, isn't he? How about his marriage to the queen?
Esther coming to him.
Yeah.
He's asking her questions.
he's beginning to have a relationship like we would expect a marriage to happen. You know, and we even saw last week there might have been a tender moment. Lauren and I have debated about that, but I think there was probably a little bit of a, hey, you know, you're kind of a partner here, right? There's this give and take. There's some flirtatious moments in chapter 5. I mean, oh my goodness, he's going back and forth, and he's hook, line, and sinker. He's taking it, right? There's none of this. He's not saying, hey, you know, let's go have a few beers, and we'll march my wife out here, and everybody can take a look at her. That's gone. He's going, what do you want, right? So this relationship between, that's reversed. Everything he didn't have before, he has now. It's really interesting, huh? But what about who his right-hand man is and was? Who did he have before? Haman. What was Haman's interest? Himself, right? Haman had three people in mind, right? Me, myself, and I. What about Mordecai? What's different about Mordecai from Haman? Huh?
He was committed to his people.
Very committed to his people. And it wasn't about him, was it? Here's a guy who was sitting by the gate and he heard a plan. And remember that. He saved the king's life and he didn't expect anything about it. He didn't crow about it. He's just sitting by the gate. Little Mordecai. Okay, so that's the king. Anything else you can think about with the king? Quite a bit's changed when you think about it. There's probably other things we could find. What about Esther? What's changed for Esther?
Her name.
Who was she before? I don't know. It was Esther, the cousin. She had a Jewish name. Well, it's funny you say that, Tim, because what's happened, too, is can you imagine living your life and not wanting anybody to know anything about you? They ask you, you know, you're in the dorm. She's in with all those gals. Where are you from? Well, you know, down the street. She's not telling anybody who she is. She's hiding her identity. So she's been able to come out of the closet, as it were, right? What else has changed for her?
Confidence.
Confidence? Who said that?
I did.
You did. Yeah. Well, how come she can have confidence?
Well, so far as she's followed the Lord's instructions or the instructions of the guide, it's come back to benefit.
Yeah, so she's got that. That's for certain.
And it's not just her. I mean, even in amongst her harem group, by listening and paying attention and following their guidance, it's benefited her.
Yeah, just think about that. I think that's interesting. So think about it. She's a nobody who's hiding in the wings, who gets spotted out because she's beautiful. But it's not just her beauty. When she goes in, and you'll remember, she doesn't take anything with her. She just is kind of a natural person. She's fearless in a way because, remember, she says, you know, I'm probably going to die here, but you know what? It is what it is. I don't know if they said that back then in Farsi. It is what it is. I don't know how to say it, but they had that it is what it is. Right? But she is now what? The queen. And she owns Haman's house. And the king is coming to her instead of Haman and saying, what's your wish? What do you want? That's a pretty unique power thing, isn't it?
She's moving from passive to active.
She's being very active now. And there's a little bit of a, you know, I don't know that I'd mess with this gal. What do you want done with the boys now?
Yeah.
Huh? I wonder what gallows they use for that. Interesting. Anyhow, so she's the queen. How about Haman? Pretty obvious. Pushing up Davies, right? Everything's reversed for him and his family. Yeah, and his legacy. Interesting. How about Mordecai? Who was he and who is he? What was he doing before? He's hanging out at the gate, right? And now he's a strategic planner. He's pretty much replaced all those guys that said, hey, you know, you ought to kick your wife out. And, you know, he's just got a whole different position in life. So everything's reversed from him. He's become very powerful. It says that, doesn't it? He can become more and more and more powerful. So there's a reversal. And what about the enemies of the Jews? That's right.
And they're so afraid and they're so awed by this God of the Jews that
that's interesting. That's funny. I have to admit, when I was a kid, one of the reasons I wanted to go to Jesus is because I was scared to death of hell. Okay, that was me. I don't want to go to hell. What do I got to do to not go to hell? Right? So there is that, right? But do you know what they called those in those days? Conversions to Judaism? Proselytes, yeah. We won't go into what they had to do to become a Jew, but anyhow, I think we all know, don't we? Okay, and what about the Jews? And the story on this isn't finished. Mordecai and the Jews isn't finished. But up to this point, what's changed for the Jews? What's reversed?
Instead of being the hunted, they're the hunter.
Well, yeah, or at least they get to defend themselves, right? It wasn't quite so hopeless before, and now we have the conclusion of this. Things have turned around. They've become a force to be reckoned with. Okay, so that's enough of that. So the fear of them had fallen on all people. What fear? What does it mean it fell on them? So now it's talking about what people, the Persians, right? So what fear do you think fell upon them when it says that? What do you think that is? Mm-hmm. It's kind of a different... I hadn't thought of it like that, but that's true. What else? What's been going on for 8 months? You remember it said that when the edict came out, they sent people out just like on the second edict. But at the end of the first edict, it says, and people were what? They were confused. So there was a lot of confusion. Like, what is the guy doing? He's up there getting drunk again with Haman, who's so full of himself, I can't stand that guy. You can imagine that. And so this goes out. It's been out there for 7.5 years. And it's, you know, people have marked their calendars. They put it on their iPad that this is the day we get to kill the Jews. And that's been out there. And then that got reversed. And then this day has come, right? And they've seen all of this. And it says who, the fear fell on who? The people and who else? What does it say? Huh? Exactly. The leadership, and what do you think, Lise, what did they see there? What do you think that they were going through when they're, you know, they're sitting here, the edict came out, and they're going, what's this guy doing, and all the leadership's behind it, because they've hopped on that bus, haven't they? And now it says they're reversing that, huh?
Yeah, the king's favor was behind Mordecai and the Jews.
That's right.
To go against that.
That's right. Yeah. Politicians, it's what politicians do best, isn't it?
That's right.
Right. Yeah?
I would think the local citizen would have thought, oh my gosh, karma.
Yeah. What comes around goes around. So, see, I guess these sayings were pretty old, huh? Yeah, so I think it's really interesting what you brought up, Lisa, that the politicians kind of jumped on board. They went, you know what, let's get behind the winner. Because that's what they do, right? And they get behind them and they say, we're for Mordecai, we always have been. What can we do to help you? Right? Yeah, their new best friend, Mordecai. In verse 12, the king makes a report to the queen. How would you characterize this? And that report was, hey, this is what's happened. Oh, it's my wife's birthday too, by the way. So I'll let her slide. you remember that he gives a report and he says, this is what's happened in Susa, the citadel. And then with an exclamation point, not a period or not a question mark, he says, how much more in the provinces? And then he goes to her and he says, ask what you want. So how do you characterize that? How do you see this going when he says this? This point in the story. Think about it like this. I kind of don't know why I thought. I guess it's because of the political season we're in, sort of, if you want to call it that. But anyhow, when the elections are out, You know, you're sitting there waiting to see the results. And then the pollsters came in and say, here's a bellwether. This is what's happened in that state. So it might predict what's going to happen. I think that's what's going on here. I think he's looked and he went, hey, it's going well here. How much better is it going to go every? If there was any place you were going to be weak, it's right here. And look, you took him. And he's pretty confident. I think, you know, he sat there and listen, this has been anything but certain. Anything but certain so far. But he's saying, hey, the outcome, it looks pretty good. And he's so confident. I think he's trying to cheer her on a little bit. And he says, what do you want to do, man? We just... And they killed all those crazy named kids of Haman. What do you want to do?
I wonder, I didn't think of it the way you're describing. I thought it was, you know, you do something at somebody's request, and then you check back for praise.
It could be.
Well,
the edict, remember the king, he says in chapter 8, basically it goes something like this. I can't change anything, but hey, look, here's my ring. You guys could, if you wanted, write your own edict and use this ring, and we can see who wins. It's like competing edicts here. Okay, so that's happened. So he's obeying the law of the Medes and the Persians, and without stacking the deck too much, he's just given them the power to fight this off. And now, some of the results are coming in. I think he's pretty excited. And he comes straight to his queen, and he's rooting for her. Another thing that I would say has changed for the king, he's actually got a marriage now. Pretty cool, huh? It's all roses.
Does he actually say, what should I do, what should I do?
What's that?
Does he actually say, what should I do?
Oh, no, well, he's saying, what would you like me to do next? That's what he's saying. He's going to his queen. Yeah, he goes, what would you have me do next? Just ask and it'll be fulfilled. This is the new language with his new queen. It's one of deference. It's really kind of cool. So he might end up being a good husband after all. Okay, the next section, I said the constant threat. And it says, what are some of your thoughts about verse 5? And I wrote it out there. The Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them. And they did as they pleased to those who hated them. Sharon, if you could put that look into words, it would be helpful there.
It's just such a gross way to say it. I mean,
oh, that sounds like a lot better way to go.
What else did they do besides killing her with a sword? I don't want to know.
You're making Steve very nervous.
I don't know what I'm swords. You've got some fishing poles on. I'm not sure. I shouldn't be nervous.
Oh, about my birthday dinner, I think I just canceled. I don't want to. Well, I agree. That kind of caught me, is they did what they pleased. Did that catch you? Yeah. Yeah, it's a little different than sitting off 200 yards and squeezing a trigger or pulling a button on a plane or controlling a drone, isn't it? You're actually listening to, yeah, doesn't take very much to go there, does it? But that's what's happening here. Oh, yeah. Yeah. The day is the day. It's decreed. Well, you know what? Thank you, because we're really going to dive into this, and I think we have to a little bit. Go ahead. Somebody says.
Could they have been converting them to Jews in the traditional way?
I'm not going there. Cutting. No, I don't know. That might be a stretch, but interesting. If it was just the guys here, we'd be having a lot of fun with that one. I'm pretty sure about that. So for that, cut that out. All right. Hmm. I'm not going to recover. I'll just move on. So, is carrying out the second edict reminiscent of any other biblical stories?
Exodus.
Yeah. Why?
Jews plundered the Egyptians.
Yeah.
They didn't plunder them here, but they pretty much had their own way.
They did. They did. In fact, there's lots of stories about them having their own way with the Ark and David. But there's one in particular, and it's covenantal. Now, the Abrahamic covenant is still in place. In chapter 15, it's still in place. It's the model of salvation that the New Testament uses. But there are other covenants that were in the Old Testament that were superseded, right? Circumcision being one of them. But there is something that occurs, and you really see a good example of it in Joshua when it starts there, and it actually starts in Exodus. But the Lord says, I'm giving you the land. It's yours. Okay? But there's a condition. What was the condition? You got to keep it, right?
Yeah.
And what else?
Don't take the plunder.
Right. Yeah. And you're too big of a guy to do it, but if you stood up, I'd have to come stand on your toes and say, this is mine. Mm-hmm. They had to put their sandals on somebody else's sandal. They had to go possess the land, which is, again, another polemic, right? When you come to accept Christ, is that it? No. There's something you have to claim, and then there's a way that you have to behave. You actually have to go do something, and what is that? It's not one of works, but you know what? You should be changed, and you should act differently, right? You should behave differently. We should be able to tell certain things about your behavior. There's an edict, and then there's a behavior. Old Testament, again, this is just picturesque of, you know what? I'm giving it to you. It's yours. It's free. But you got to go do something about it. And here's the same thing again. Here's the edict, but you know what? Now you got to go out and you got to put the sword through them. There's something else involved here. Okay, and then we go into how long were the Jews living with the threat of extinction here? That's why I gave you the timeline there. Yeah, 8 months. And it could be a year and 8 months depending on what expert's timeline you want to use here. So it's at least 8 months. And remember, this is going to happen. This is the law of the what? Medes and the Persians. And it's certain. And you hear this throughout the Old Testament when it says the law of Medes and Persians is certain, right? So they've been living with this threat of extension for a while. Now, that Haman is gone, why not just say, you know what, Haman's gone, let's just let it go. What do you think?
It would never have been.
What's that? It would never have been? Yeah.
I mean, they're a very tribal people. Those things are held for generations. They're still held for generations today. And it would never have been. And I think that's why she chose to hang the sons of Haman. Because she needed the signal that they would understand.
We're serious, huh?
And it's done.
Yeah, we have to. How long has this actually been going on? You remember we talked about that in chapter 3? Huh? The Amalekites, right. From Exodus. Remember the Lord said, he goes, you know what, one day I'm going to surely wipe these guys out. And then when we get to Saul, he says, okay, this is the time. Yeah, and Saul didn't do it. And now here we are later. Okay. So it's been going on for a while. If we would have killed Hitler somewhere around the beginning of the war, would it have changed the war? What do you think? You know, most experts think if we would have killed them, they might have won. It wasn't going to stop it. They were just going to get better at it because he made a lot of mistakes. Probably it was God's hand that stayed his execution early on, because without him, it's really determined. He had some pretty good second and third people in rank that were smarter and better war tacticians than he was. And they wouldn't have made some of the major mistakes in Russia. So killing Hitler doesn't necessarily do away with this, right? Okay. Last week, Lauren asked, what was the primary difference between competing decrees? Is there any significant difference? Now, you're going to have to get your Bibles out, and you're going to have to look at 313, which is the earlier decree, and 811, and I'm not going to give this to you, so you should look at those. and see if you can figure that out. Or maybe you know. I'll give you a hint. The difference, so you don't have to look both of them up, the difference is going to be found in verse 11 of chapter 8 on the last sentence. That's the one thing that is different between the two competing decrees. And it's also mentioned in this one. I don't remember where. Huh? It's not the plunder. They can take the plunder. What's the last sentence there in verse 11? Maybe I got the wrong verse.
It's the first edict would allow the people to kill any Jewish person of any age, gender, or position. The second edict was to kill the armed men who were going to try and kill them.
This is the doctrine of self-defense. There's a difference between Mordecai's, and that's very good, Lisa. There is a little mercy, a little grace, but it's in self-defense. That's the difference here. The first edict is just malicious. It's to plunder. It's to exterminate. It's just based on hate, you know. And this one is, you know what? You can go out there and you can defend your lives. In fact, you have an obligation now because it's a decree. There's an obligation here to defend themselves. You know, one could say when they, you know, with the first decree and you were going to get attacked, you know, they were probably going to fight back, but they were going to do it in a singular fashion. They weren't allowed to gather. They weren't allowed to congregate. It was just, you know, 20 guys come to your house, you do the best you can, and then you're done. And they go to the next house and so on and so forth. So it's different. Oh, I missed. How are the Jews going to carry out the second decree or edict? And it's through gathering. Okay, I'll just give it to you since I blew it, right? So they gathered together. That was the difference. They are allowed to gather together to defend themselves. Okay, so the gravity of the situation is, and I borrowed this from, you don't have it up on the screen, but I borrowed this from the movie La Bella Vita. Has anybody seen that movie, La Bella Vita? It's an Italian movie. I wish I had an Italian accent to read this, but you'll have to suffer through. So I wrote this out. In the movie La Bella Vita, there's a scene where a father and a son are riding on their bicycles and they go down over the cobbled squares into town. And as they ride in there, the graffiti on the stone walls, that it features Nazi symbols and slogans. And the boy says to the dad, "What does it say?" "No Jews," or he says, "Why does it say no Jews or dogs allowed?" And the father, not wanting to crush his son by the reality of what is on the wall, makes light of it, purposefully, in an attempt to save his son from the implications of the message. And he says to him, "Everybody does what they want to do," he says. "You see that hardware store over there? They don't let Spanish people in there. Spanish people on horses are not allowed in there." And he says, "You know, there's a store over there as well, and I have a Chinese friend who has a kangaroo, and we were going to go into that store over there, and they told me no. No Chinese and no kangaroos," he says. "So you see, son, people don't like Chinese and kangaroos, and some people don't like Spanish and horses. That's really all it is." And as the film progresses, you only go about a minute or so into the future before the trucks come, before the divisions start taking place, before the girls are sent away by themselves, and before you have that classic scene in the movie where Roberto is running behind the truck shouting, "Is there somebody there called Dora? Is Dora there? She's Italian. She's my wife. She's called Dora." And before the truck slips away, her face appears from the morass of humanity. And he identifies her and he shouts to her, "Get off the truck, Dora. Jump off the truck, Dora, as soon as you can." And you fast forward, and there is a scene where Roberto appears in an emaciated condition common to the hard enslavement camp. And his boy, his little boy, is hidden in the rafters. This is where he attempts to keep the boy out of harm's way. And the boy's skinny little legs dangle from the perch. And he says, "Daddy, they make soap and buttons out of us. They make soap and buttons out of us. Now, when you get that, you're starting to approximate the context in which the second edict in effect says, go take care of that situation. That's the gravity of the situation. That happens. Gesundheit. So that's what we're talking about here. Defending, and this is how serious that is. And so that's why they carried this out and they did as they pleased. People died by the sword. It's just a reality. Okay, the great restraint. Now we're going to talk about that plunder thing. In the second edict, the Jews are authorized to plunder their goods. The text is repetitive in verse 5 or 10, 5, 16. They lay no hands on the plunder. Why do you think they kept their hands off the booty? Why didn't they do it this time? What do you think? Now remember, and I have here, I'll read this for you first. Now go and strike Amalek and devote to destruction all that they have. That means all the stuff. And then do not spare them, but kill both the man and the woman, child, infant, ox, and the sheep, camel, and donkey. That's in 1 Samuel. Why do you think that the Lord did that? Why the harshness? Remember when I brought this up last time we talked about this, I went, you know, what did the donkey ever do? Right? Seems kind of cruel. Or the child.
It's kind of precedent.
Yeah?
Let it be known what will be happening.
This is a big question, isn't it? And it's one of those that you'll get when you're debating atheists, which I used to want to do. And they say, you know, God's cruel. God is merciless. You know, how can you tell me he's a God of mercy? Look what he's doing here. Right? So it's a fair question. Why? It's a hard question. I wish this would have fell on Eric or Scott to teach this part.
It seems like it's nothing more serious of a judgment than God pronounced.
There is nothing worse, is there?
So God is trying to get across in some way that what the Amalekites.
Yeah, and all that time, you just don't have any stories about them ever converting. You don't have any stories there. You know, and Satan is involved in a lot of things that are going on here. But there are a couple of instances in the Old Testament where we see this being played out. Okay, and one of them is in 2 Kings and in Genesis. 2 Kings 5:50, that's the whole story of Naaman. And you remember he gets healed and there's this really colorful exchange. I'm pretty sure that Elisha was a little bit of a narcissist and Naaman definitely is, and they're bumping heads. But at any rate, at the end of the day, Naaman gets cured through some coaxing, you know, and he comes back and he's got his hat in his hand and he says, thank you so much. What can I give you? You remember that? And he says, nothing. And then Elijah, his servant, follows him and says, hey, you know what you could do is make a little donation here. And then he ends up getting it. And there's a reason why Elijah tells him that. And it's basically the same thing that in Genesis happens when Abraham meets with Melchizedek. And then the king, and the king says, here, you know what? Take this for your trouble. And he says, no, I won't take so much as a sandal from you. My men, you know, whatever they've, you know, spent in rations and food, go ahead and repay them that. But no. And he tells them, because he says, I don't want anybody to think that the reason that I'm successful is because of what you did. Okay? So there's kind of a concept going on here. I said, how am I going to communicate these stories? And so I just made the story up, and I think hopefully it gives you the right display. It says, and this is another dad-son conversation. It says, Dad, isn't it true that back in the day, Grandpa defeated the enemies of the Jews, and a battle ensued, and they took them by the sword? Yes, son. I was about your age when it happened. Why didn't they take their swords? We could use them for training purposes and trophies. And what about their rings and bracelets? We could have had them as heirlooms, and we could have even sold them for good money. Was it too hard to get them? No, son. We could have taken all their property. Then why? We did what we did, first of all, because they threatened our lives and our very existence was at stake. Secondly, we are the children of Abraham. We are the children of promise. We are to trust and rely on God and God alone. We cannot risk others getting the wrong idea about our success or how we endure hardship. They could easily attribute our blessing to the taking of the plunder instead of the provision of God. We just can't succumb to the temptation of stuff. Our purpose is to represent God. So in a nutshell, I think that's what it's kind of saying. Excuse me for paraphrasing. But that's what some of these instances are saying. Because of who they are. They're the children of promise. They have to behave differently. And there's obviously applications for us, right? Okay, celebration. We'll move through this and get to the application part. In verse 16, we find an important strategy for the success followed by celebrating. Is there any connection between the two? I don't know if I was real clear about that because we'd have to go back to 16. But basically, you'll see that there is sort of a genre here of gathering. And we're going to see that this really sets up Nehemiah. Jim and I were talking about Nehemiah, and you go to chapter 3 in Nehemiah. I just encourage you to do it. Read that. It's a beautiful chapter because it names all the people who work together. And when you get to the New Testament, of course, this is all projecting forward. You're going to see Paul many times who tells us to gather. In Philippians, he says, you know, strive to work side by side. Be together. And I'll end with a little bit more of a when we talk about that. And then what are they celebrating?
Survival.
Survival, right? They were delivered. Protection. Okay, and then there's a psalm there for you. What to avoid? Is there anything worse than a glib Christian? I don't think so. What do you think? And what do I mean by that? So this is a story about providence. God is providing a delivery to them. And I think we really have to be careful is when people are suffering or hurting, we don't quote scriptures to try to make them feel better or to act like our lives are all together because we're Christians. You know, people suffer. And I don't want this story to be about us putting on a thin veil like I used to when I'd come to church and the wife and I and the kids are all in a squabbling mass before we get here and we get out of the church, we're all better. And you know, you're exhausted by the time you're just happy to see the kids go, you know, instead of just being real saying, you know what, somebody asks you how you doing, you want my kids? Fear versus presence. And I got this because the elders get together, both unemployed and employed elders get together at the end of every month, and they pray for the congregation. And you know, it's an interesting time because it's one of my favorite things that we do, and it's one of the things I hate that we do because it only takes about 5 minutes, and you understand as elders and as people, we're pretty helpless. There's not a lot we can do about the problems that come before us. We really do have to throw this on the Lord. And it's very emotionally draining sometimes because you know these people, you care about these people, right? And it's easy to think that if the Lord's presence is with us, that we're not afraid. But that's not true. I don't know about you. I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning worrying. In a class this size, surely there's somebody who has a prodigal son. And you do this on the driveway looking and hoping to see them return to the Lord. Does that keep you up at night? It wouldn't be. It does me. I have a daughter that is far from the Lord. So we can understand this story. But it's really important that we act like we don't have anxieties and we don't have fear. And I know the Lord says, you know, you be anxious for nothing. And that usually goes out the window pretty quick. I think we have to be really legitimate about this. And then understand what providence is about. So why does he put us in these situations, do you think? Why do you think we get together and we pray and we see, you know, that people have cancer and we're getting older and people's kids are walking away from the Lord and all the things that happen in a population of a church, and yet we're trying to walk with God, and we know that He's going to answer our prayers, why does He allow these things to happen? What do you think after this, almost finishing the story? We rely on Him. So in this story, what happens is, when you throw up your hands and you go, I can't help Kevin's baldness, or whatever it is, right? Sorry, Kev. There you go. Okay. Whatever it is. But something really serious, if something was really serious and I couldn't do anything for you, it brings me to my knees. And when things happen in my life, what did they say? There's no atheists in foxholes or delivery rooms. Really true, right? Something happens to your kid, I'm telling you, it'll take the wind right out of you. Travis almost died when he was 2 years old. He had pneumonia, and he says, you know, if it's bacterial, he'll probably live. If it's viral, he'll probably die. I'll tell you what, I was on the floor. And so he allows these things because what does it do? What did it do in this story? What did they do? They got in sackcloth, right? Lauren talked about it. When they got in sackcloth, what did that mean? Mourning or praise, or praying, right? They fasted, right? Okay. Your great reversal. This story points to a great reversal, doesn't it? What's the great reversal you think it's pointing to? Huh? Yeah? What do you think? Anybody? Is God going to rescue humanity? Sections of it, huh? Right? What have you been praying for? If somebody asked you, hey, I don't know anything about this Jeezy, do you pray? Yeah. What have you been praying for? Do you have an answer for that? Is there something you've been praying for a long time? Huh? Is there a prayer that's been going on in your life for more than a week? A month? A year? There should be. There should be all of those above, right? Can God reverse a thing for you? What happens if you've been praying for 10 years and it still hasn't happened? What usually happens then? Huh? You get. Yeah, truthfully, I quit praying for it. Right? Or if you have been faithful and continue to pray for that, you know what a lot of times happens? Is God changes your heart and your expectation. He changes your prayer. There'll be a change. God will answer that in some way. Just stick with it, right? He's going to deliver you. He's going to reverse. You know, all these reversals in the Bible, they speak to one ultimate reversal that we saw in the New Testament, which was, and there's a celebration here, what was the reversal in the New Testament that's pinnacle to our faith?
Resurrection.
The resurrection, right? And is there more reversals to come after that? Huh? Our resurrection. You get into Revelation, and I listened to a great debate one time, and John Lennox, somebody says, well, you know, your God is doing this in the future, he's doing this, and he goes, oh, I'm sorry, I've given you the wrong impression. It isn't what God's going to do in the future, it's what he's going to undo in the future. He's going to undo my death. He's going to undo my tears. He's going to undo these things. And these little pictures that we get here, they stack them up in the Old Testament. They're all over the place if you're looking for them like we started out, right? Okay. I think that's about all I got for you guys. And then I would just ask you, is there anything that God can't do for you? Anything? There is nothing he can't do for you. If he can raise his son from the dead, if he can make this beautiful earth and all the people in it and all this stuff, and he can undo all that, he can undo one simple prayer for you. So I encourage you to keep praying, if you would. Pray for those reversals and bring somebody in on it with you. Start praying with your wife. Eric was talking about praying with his wife at the meeting, and I said, you know, I'm not praying with my wife enough. We started doing that as a result of that, and I'm telling you, it was a great week for her. It was a better week for her than it was for me, but my week's coming next week. So, anyway, Jim, you want to close us in prayer?